One of the questions I get asked a lot by anyone sane enough to not involve themselves in the construction industry is, why does it cost so much to build housing? There are many answers to this question, and like everything, the answers are a little bit more complicated than we wish them to be. There is no shortage of people, however, who will tell you that there is a simple answer or a quick fix, but those people are either lying or just don't know what they're talking about. My guest today, on the other hand, does know what he's talking about. Paul Mitchell is the co-founder of Mitchell McDermott, a firm that specializes in construction consultancy and quantity surveying. Paul not only helps run that firm with his co-founder, but he also donates his time to work on various reports setting out the state of the construction industry, including sitting on the working group of the Housing Commission. He doesn't have any quick fixes, because nobody does. I hope you enjoy our conversation. If I was 5 years old, how would you explain what a quantity surveyor is?
Scary people with abacuses. I suppose, like, in simple terms, a quantity surveyor, there's two types. There's one that works for clients, and there's one that works for a contractor, and they're two completely different jobs. And the one that works for a client is like their financial guardian for construction. And their job is to give you the answer before you start and to make sure that you keep to that answer through the development period. So when you come to me and you say you have a site and you say, I'm thinking of putting resi on it, I will say, what type? And I will say, well, here is the different types and here's how much they cost from a benchmark point of view. So data is huge. And we will go through, we will work with you and the architects to say, here's an efficient design, here's how you should be doing it. And then, because as a quantity surveyor acting for a client, that is where you have your biggest impact. You're saving the millions up front at concept stage. And then as you move through sketch design and detailed design, you're saving the hundreds of thousands. And then by the time you get to the construction stage, then you're dealing with the contractor's quantity surveyor on the other side, because you literally are opposite ends of the table. And you're negotiating with that contractor as you move through. All the time you're keeping to the client's original plan, which at this stage is 3 or 4 years old. So forecasting and starting with the end in mind is the key part of a PQS, referred to when they work for a client.
Right. And then you, as part of all of that, you survey quantities, right? You measure.
Correct. Yeah. So I suppose that the technical part of the job, it's a mix. When I did quantity, when I went into quantity surveying, and I was either going to be a quantity surveyor or an engineer. An engineer is a deep dive, right? They know all the detail and have to do everything to exacting standards. And with quantity surveying, what I found when I did the course, there was like 12 different subjects. So there was business subjects, technical subjects, and, you know, financial subjects. So when you went in, you were doing physics, you were doing maths, you were doing tech drawing and measurement, right? But at the same time, you were doing accounting and economics, and then you were doing the business management subjects, which is fantastic, because when you go in, you kind of got a wide range of skills that you use. Because as a PQS advising a client, it's not just about measuring. I remember being interviewed when I was in my, I was a first year out of college working for PQS, and I got interviewed for what my job was. And the title was Not Just a Matter of Counting Bricks, long time ago now. But so the measurement part is the technical bit, but I think the strategic advice that you're giving a client and where to go to is the most important bit.
Yeah.
So, and then if you're working for a contractor, you're very much dealing with subcontractors, you are dealing with a lot of measurement, and you're typically based on site.
Yeah.
So two very different roles, to be honest, even though both the quantity surveyors.
So in your role, say for Mitchell McDermott, you're a full service firm, right? So you could act for somebody like me as a developer, you could act for a bank, you could, but you wouldn't typically work for a contractor, for a main contractor.
No, actually, we have it as a rule that we don't ever work for a contractor, just simply because we end up in a conflict of interest. So like, you can't be paying me one day and the following day I'm sitting in a room with you negotiating for my client.
Yeah.
So that's a rule that we had from day one. But, you know, our business is basically we do three things. About 45% of our work is project management. About the same is quantity surveying. And we have a bit that waxes and wanes between 5 to 10% in the middle, which is acting for banks, you know, doing due diligence and project monitoring.
Okay. So as part of the project management then, and I know I don't want to spend all day talking about this because we have a lot of stuff to get through. But the project management end of that, that's where like a developer would come to you who's a little bit light maybe on expertise, right? So they're more of a promoter or a landowner and they say, well, I want to get planning permission for this and I want to build it, but don't necessarily have any experience doing that. They'd come to you and you'd say, well, we can do that. We can oversee it. We can oversee the tendering process for the main contractor. We can oversee the quantity surveying services, drawdowns from the bank, all this stuff. And you can do that all under the one roof.
Correct, yeah. And a lot of our projects will be delivered, a lot of our clients are overseas. So they have no boots on the ground here at all.
Yeah.
So we will take it from a concept right through to the end, to handover and the defects liability period at the end.
Okay.
You know, so you're still dealing with projects that are finished.
Okay. So you must have a very broad range of staff, like down to guys maybe who are starting out, who are doing the actual measurement and saying there's a million bricks and there's meant to be 1.2 million, all the way up to the guy who's actually making the big decision and saying, well, you know, don't use that or...
Yeah, and it is a good mix. We have 70 volunteers as we currently stand. Anyone can walk out.
Martyrs.
Martyrs, yeah. But it's a good group because when we set up, you know, I spent 20 years in the one business, in effect, through mergers and acquisitions. And the last acquisition was by an American corporate. And I grew up in an owner-controlled business, so I wanted to get back to that. Mm. So myself and Anthony McDermott set up from scratch in March 2015, you know, things were still a little bit bleak, but there were green shoots. And we grew quite rapidly up through, you know, 2019, then COVID, Ukraine, et cetera, and we've, you know, remained at about 70 people throughout that period. So, but yeah, you do need from directors down to graduates, and a big part of our business is training.
Right.
So you will not keep people unless you are training them. It is not enough to pay someone.
What's your focus in the business? Do you look at research or, I mean, because I know that you, and we're going to get on some of the research that the firm has put out because a lot of it's very interesting, but is that something that you personally concentrate on or is there another area that you're?
I think across the business, I think we do as a business focus on data because I think that is the lifeblood of proper decision making. But like each year, we started off with one info card. Now we produce 12, which is, if you say it in our office around October time, it's like mentioning the Leaving Cert because people have to put all their data into two sides of an A4 page, which is never easy, but it means they're digestible.
Yeah.
Research piece is a small piece, a part of what we do. My piece, I'm heavily involved in commercial and residential. I have a big interest in residential. I sit on the viability group within the Housing Commission, worked in PII, I've done a lot of voluntary work for the Society of Chartered Surveyors. So that's a real interest of mine.
Yeah.
You know, dare I say passion.
Yeah. Well, it's a good thing to be passionate about. You brought up viability there. Viability is a very hot topic in the development industry. We have on the one hand, people like me, others, that are screaming for several years about how difficult it is to construct apartments. You then have a group, I'm trying to think of a polite term to describe them, but you probably know who I'm talking about. There's really four of them who I'm not going to name, but if they deign to listen to the podcast, which I'm sure that they won't, they will readily be able to identify themselves. A cabal of half academics, I would describe them as the anti-vaxxers of the property world, who claim that, in fact, there's no issue with viability and that you can build houses for basically nothing. And it's just a big profit-hungry game by big greedy developers, which I freely admit I am a big greedy developer, or maybe just a greedy developer, not very big. You are an independent voice on this. You're not a developer. You don't work for contractors. You're going to be employed regardless of whether there is a lot of profit, a little bit of profit. Your role is at the nexus of all of this. Is there a viability problem with apartment construction in Ireland?
Yes.
Thank you for that very simple answer.
Like, you know, I have the same reaction when I hear people who are given a significant amount of airtime who do not actually work in the industry. It pains me because that is what the public listen to. And when in 2015, I wrote a report for Property Industry Ireland on apartment development because I followed it. We were involved in a significant amount of apartments through the boom. 2007, right? Negativity around, remember the late Liam Carroll and shoebox apartments down a Bachelor's Walk.
Yeah.
That was, you know, in the rise in the kind of late 90s, early 2000s, that was, you know. So 2007, the department brought out their guidelines and they said, this is, which is great. Here's the minimum sizes.
Yeah.
They had one fatal line on it, which was, these are minimum standards. City and county councils should improve on these where possible. You know, at that stage, in 2008, we tracked all this and we measured it all, and it's out there for the public to see. The councils then started checking. Cork City Council, Dublin City Council, Dunleary right down, and others brought out their own guidelines. And they said, no, we want the sizes to be 10% bigger. You can only build 3 apartments per core. We want 100% dual aspect. And I remember being on apartment schemes in Sandyford at the time, trying to redesign these schemes, and they were absolutely decimated.
Yeah.
That was 2008, and then the world stopped, right? 2014, you know, the end of 2014, beginning of 2015, set up Mitchell McDermott, and I was a member of PII at the time. And they said, our project, our apartment's viable. You know, I said, well, you know, here are the issues. And we did some costs and we showed that the changes they made in 2008, which never were changed, no. Right, got added, you know, all this significant money to the apartments. So we met with politicians, we met with councillors, we met with county councils and planners. And through all the talk that was going on at the time, changes were made, dual aspect. And what they did was, which was really useful, they repealed the 2008 changes,
yeah,
if you remember.
I remember that.
And they basically brought them back to 2007. And then a year later, they introduced Build to Rent as a new asset class. But during 2016, we gathered, working for the SCSI voluntary capacity, I led the report on apartment viability. The SCSI had done the previous report the year before on housing, and we did this.
And just for anyone who's listening, the SCSI is the Society of Chartered Surveyors in Ireland. So they're kind of the umbrella group that handle the certification and that of surveyors, yeah, right across the property spectrum. So they're well respected.
They're well respected because they are independent. You know, they're not a lobby group, actually a charity. But then we carried out this report and we said, okay, let's take all this data from people, anonymized data from quantity surveying firms for all these apartment blocks. And at the time we got about 3,000 apartments back. We analyzed that and we did the development appraisal. And I remember the day the report was issued, and the PR guy within the SCSI came back and said, the Irish Times are not going to run with the story because they don't believe it. Okay. No, yeah. Wait. 24 hours later, right? So that day it was launched. We launched it. We presented it to the politicians and journalists, and then we presented it to the members. And this report, for the first time, put out site data, construction costs, sales information, viability across a range of apartment types. Every paper ran with it. The Irish Times came back and said, put 2 articles that week on it. And it was fantastic because it was the first time, but we did get from some of the quarters that you talked about, someone asked us to say, can you put an image to show, you know, what do you mean when you say a core in an apartment block? It was just, you know. Yeah. And one of those commentators came back to say, oh, look at the report. It's based on a scheme that wouldn't get a fire cert. In actual fact, deliberately, it was an image from a scheme in the United States, so it wouldn't reflect any scheme here. It was just,
just to pause you there, without you giving me any other information, I know precisely the individual
I won't mention her
on this podcast, but anyway.
But here's the thing, right? So at that point, some great things happened. 2 great things happened. We got the apartment regs changed, Build-to-rent came in as a new asset class, but more importantly, international funds came into the market.
Yeah.
Because I can remember at the time doing scheme after scheme of build-to-sell viability checks for NAMA that wouldn't work.
Yeah.
And I remember the chap sitting across the table from me, who was currently a client of mine, saying, how come apartments don't work?
Yeah.
Right?
Because I know where you're going with that, and I really only bring this up because last week I was at a wedding and I'm sitting next to somebody who I was trying to explain this point to, and Rebecca, if you're listening, we never came to an understanding. But when you say you looked at the viability check for, say, build regular apartments, right? That's building them to sell them. So it's building a bunch of apartments and trying to get people to buy them. Ordinary purchasers. We hear this a lot. And there's a whole episode later planned about this idea of these funds are coming in, they're buying apartments that otherwise will be bought by individuals. So you were doing viability checks. And as part of that, you're looking at the cost of producing the apartment and you're looking at the end value of the apartment, what they can be sold for and the time frame in which they can be sold. Mm-hmm. And the result of that is that one doesn't meet the other, right? The revenue is not meeting the cost. Ergo, you do not have to be a chartered surveyor to figure out that nobody is going to build something in which they lose money. So that's where we were. What year was that when you were doing that stuff for NAMA? That was sort of 15, 16?
It was 15, 16, yeah.
Yeah, so it even was, at that point, which is okay now, it's 7, 8 years ago and it feels like a lifetime. But at the time, the property industry was on the floor. There wasn't a whole lot of construction going on. Tender prices were low. Construction material prices were a lot lower than they are now. A lot of the new regulations around fire and things that have come in recently were not present then. Construction costs was a lot lower in 2015, and yet it still did not make sense to build these things and to sell them.
Correct. Yeah. And, you know, like, if you think about it, we were building apartments back in, you know, the early 2000s. Or somewhere, there used to be a magic figure of 1650 a square meter.
Okay.
That figure now is between 2,400 and 3,000.
Yeah, I was going to say, probably closer to 3,000 in most cases.
Depending on the scheme. And like the report, hopefully, that will be issued soon has got all that data. And now for the latest report, which has just been issued to the Housing Commission, has 14,000 apartments in it. Right? But the point was PRS came in, or built to rent. And because it was a completely different model, it was rent divided by a yield, right?
Yeah.
They somehow magic, it was able to happen, yeah. Right? Fantastic. Schemes were getting built.
Yeah.
The things really started happening at that point.
Yeah.
We built rent and the funds because we couldn't get finance. The banks weren't lending enough and build to sell isn't viable. Right. So PRS or build to rent came in. Build to rent was the technical planning guidelines that are now no longer. PRS is the generic term for a private rental sector where we're just renting units. This was working and we were producing units. And it's the thing that I grieves me a little bit is as soon as something is working, we change it.
Yeah.
We cut build to rent. The political pressure mounts. We cut co-living,
yeah.
Right? Like, how many co-living schemes were we ever going to build anyway? Okay.
Yeah.
And we need space for key workers, right? We need space for everyone. And one of the things that we've been talking about recently is in terms of solutions, what we actually need. So we've been cutting it all down, right? So that everyone has to get a Mercedes, whether they can afford it or not. And what we actually need is we need a graduated ladder of housing typologies.
Yeah.
We need to be, as a student, be in subsidized on-campus student accommodation. We need to have purpose-built student accommodation that is subsidized or not, but it needs to be affordable. And this is the key part in the early stages of the curve. How do we get affordability? Viability and affordability, two completely different things. How do we then move to a share, a professional share, co-living, right, type arrangement? And how do we then move to a PRS apartment or cost rental or affordable purchase? And if we had those typologies for those and that kind of housing ladder, we would cut out a lot of planning issues, both in terms of planners making mistakes, designers designing the wrong things, and developers, dare I say it, putting forward the wrong thing. Right? I see it all the time, the wrong schemes out there. There's a lot of schemes that are stalled, and some of those are reasons for that. But instead of kind of having this graduated typology in place, we're actually cutting down the typologies that we did put in place.
And we're doing that as a reaction to outrage that's based on nothing other than just dogma, right? That there shouldn't be, everyone should be living in a really large apartment, whether they want to or not. They shouldn't be high. They should be near everything. Everyone should have a parking space, but no one should have a car. You know, we are, it is schizophrenic, the pace and the manner in which policy around this stuff has been made of late. The media, I have to say, have a large part to play in that by amplifying voices of people who don't know what they're talking about. We've discussed that already. But the politicians also have a bit more responsibility around this, because I do believe a lot of them understand what you're saying, but it is quite convenient to get on board with the Twitterati and just say the popular thing, which is down with apartment developments, but we need housing.
I have a different view.
Okay.
I feel relatively more positive over the last couple of years.
The last couple of years or the last couple of weeks? Because the last couple of years have, I think, been, I mean, look at all the things that have happened. Built to rent was cut. That was an absolutely ridiculous decision that was based on nothing other than, you know, outrage. Co-living was cut. Ridiculous decision that nobody could justify with any kind of data or evidence.
Correct.
Building regulations in an inflationary environment continually being upgraded to the point where we've seen increases recently over two different apartment blocks just on sprinklering, costing €15,000 more per apartment because of needing to sprinkler the basements, needing to have telemetry to all the heads, needing to sprinkler the common areas. All this stuff that you can't argue against it, right? Because, oh, then you're anti-fire safety. But there is a world that exists without any of that that's perfectly safe. But we seem to live in a world when we won't take the lessons of what's gone in other countries, and we just kind of come up with our own. So yeah. I'm kind of curious as to why you feel optimism over the last couple of years. The last couple of weeks, I think there's been a number of things, actually, a couple of months even, that have been positive. But expand on that a little bit. What are you optimistic about?
I think I agree with you in terms of, you know, build to rent. However, the build to rent one is like people got very upset over built to rent.
Yeah.
And I give a presentation at the IPI conference last November, and I said there's not much difference between built to rent and built to sell in the regulations.
Yeah.
Right? Your mix is allowed, you're allowed to go over 12 apartments per core, you're allowed to have less balconies, your average size doesn't have to be 5% bigger. Mm. Look at the schemes, look at the amount of built to rent schemes that are out there. There aren't actually that many. People went because they didn't like to be stuck with this 15-year covenant. So they just got built to sell planning permissions and rented the buildings, otherwise known as PRS. So that in itself isn't really going to hurt things. What does hurt things is the likes of Dublin City Council saying 40% of apartment buildings have to be built to sell.
Yeah.
Now that is the death knell for apartments in Dublin. That by itself kills everything.
Well, I was going to say that you're right. People didn't want to be tied into the rental thing because they had the option of not doing it with relatively little penalty. But the reaction to that happening was exactly that. Dublin City Council saying, you know, 40% of apartments had to be built to sell. Dunleary rat down and others now instituting conditions into the planning permissions, which I would say are wholly illegal, requiring you not to rent the property. Now, talk about infringement of property rights if someone had the guts to go down the road of challenging that. Like, it would be tossed. And that has been the reaction to it now, this idea that renting is bad, and so we're not going to build any rental housing. which says renters are second-class citizens who do not need to be taken care of. Not everybody wants to buy a house. Not everybody is living here forever. Some people are coming here for a few years to work, or they're coming here because they met their boyfriend or girlfriend and they are going to leave and go to wherever. Mm. Why they felt the need to start targeting renters under the auspices of targeting landlords, right? Because you hear a lot of this language is actually about settled areas and about displaced populations and about, like, it's not sustainable, which is all code for, we don't want renters here. We want homeowners, because homeowners are better people. And
but like, if you look at the way it's done, it's like in the Liberties, you know, they brought in purpose-built student accommodation, right? And the Liberties was an area that wasn't regenerated during the boom, the last boom. And you went there and there were these neighbors were up in arms and complaining about these students, these noisy students that were going to come in and we're not going to have this. Anyway, the planning got through and it was pre the enlightenment of JR rules. And the owner, the guy that was the most advent kind of noisy neighbor, came up to the owner one day and he said, look, when are you actually going to move these students in? Mm. You know, he said, they've been in 2 months. He said, what?
Yeah.
So, you know, and next thing, there's like six or seven schemes now down in Newmarket, right? For
Newmarket is transformed by that.
Fantastic, lovely shops, the distilleries, all the rest right down there. But to wind back a sec, because I've gone down a tangent, but in terms of the positive things that I think, so yeah, that was a negative. Co-living was a miss, right? I just think it's really poor, you know, and going back to when you say I'm independent, my clients are developers. So from that point of view, anyone listening go, well, he would say that because he acts for developers. So I'll put that out there. But, you know, we did our first co-living scheme in Dunleary, you know, which is up there and built. And we have another four on the way, but that's about all that has planning.
Yeah. And there will be no more.
No, there will be no more.
Yeah.
No. And so I think that was a miss. And I think hopefully some shape of that will come back into play at some point again. But if you look at, I suppose, what's been happening, if we didn't have the change in terms of the LDA, if we didn't have the AHB's cost rental, right, this industry would have just stalled right now. Mm. Like the amount of insolvency, I would say, around apartment schemes would be very high because there wasn't an alternative. So that's very positive. It's provided an alternative. The government, so, and look, if you look at them, we kind of track all the changes that happen, and there are a myriad of things that have come into play. All these deposit scheme, first home schemes, the most recent STAR one, which is cost rental for private developers. So every few months, there's something new has been introduced to the point that it's confusing. And people say, oh, it's very confusing now. I say, well, that's okay. It's okay to be confused about if we've got measures that are helping, like Craig Cunningham or whatever.
Yeah, you can work it out. If you're confused, you can figure it out, and it's better than there being just
better
a
than
shrug.
Nothing, yeah. Right? So, but the state can't. So the only thing here, construction costs are going to continue to increase.
Yeah.
And we did that study that we'll probably talk about, comparing the costs with the other cities in Europe for the government recently. Issued, published it in May. And, you know, and that looked at, you know, it was a very deep dive insight into construction costs here, because the mantra is the same. Ireland's too expensive, rip off Ireland, construction costs are way too high. And for the first time, we have a report out there that's done a really, really deep dive, like for like comparison.
Yeah. So what you did there was you did this traveling box, right? So you designed, and for anyone, we'll post a link to the report because it is publicly available in the show notes. It's very long. And it's very detailed. But if you have an interest in how this thing actually works and you want actual facts, I encourage you to go and read it. At least read the introduction and the summary. If you're not going to read the odd 90 pages of it, fair enough. So you took the traveling box, which is an apartment you designed, and you said, let's build this apartment in Dublin, in somewhere in
Birmingham.
In Birmingham. Utrecht in the Netherlands.
And, Berlin.
And Berlin.
And Copenhagen.
And Copenhagen, right?
Five cities in total.
What did you find?
Well, so it was fascinating because people have tried to do this before, and there are other reports that are out there, and they compare things at a high level.
Yeah.
And if you look at those, and in it, we did the list review, and you'll show that every report says something different.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
So we actually took four different asset classes, We took housing, scheme housing, urban apartments, suburban apartments, and purpose-built student accommodation. So it was a heavy lift because we did four asset classes across five cities.
So you had four travelling boxes, really.
We had four travelling boxes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so we had 20 development appraisals, or cost comparisons, not development appraisals. And so when we took the travelling box, so the purpose of this report was the government to say, okay, go off, look at those other four cities, come back and tell us how we can reduce construction costs. That was the purpose of the report. And when we so in our methodology, in fairness, they put together a very good steering group that had a very detailed brief, construction costs only.
Yeah.
What we found was that when we took the Irish apartment block and we got a price by quantity surveyors in the four other cities, the cost difference was plus or minus 4%. Okay. It was negligible. You would lose that in a tender in the Irish market on the exact same job to five contractors.
Quite easily, yeah.
And I was kind of going, it took us, the kind of, there was 6,000 lines of pricing in the apartment block. So it's an actual apartment block in Dublin that was tendered, right? So we had real cost out. And the fact that everyone was priced in the travelling box cut out inflation, cut out technological differences, cut out building standard differences. It was just
so pricing. This is down to you're specifying the brick, the wall makeup, the type of mechanical installation, everything is the same. Mm. And how much does it cost in Denmark? How much does it cost in Utrecht? How much does it cost in Dublin, etc.?
So we did that. So then I went, whoa, that's I was expecting all these other cities to be lower. Why are they not lower?
Mm.
Right? So then our second pass, which was always planned, was that we would go in and we say, okay, well, here is our Irish product. Now, Rick, you tell us what you're building for in Utrecht, Copenhagen, Berlin, and Birmingham. The costs came back from the other Ricks between 17 and 30% lower. And we were kind of going, hang on, you've just priced 6,000 lines of data. It's taken us 6 months to get through. And now you're telling us that this changes.
So I wasn't personally surprised when I read that. And that's just because I've talked to people in other countries about it and about the standards that we have here. This is down to the Mercedes and the Toyota, right? We're building a Mercedes. And in Utrecht and in Denmark, they're maybe not building quite a Mercedes.
Yeah, and it's in some cases we're not comparing apples with apples, right? So
what do you mean by that?
So in some cases, so if we go here, we build an apartment and you've got floor finishes, you've got your full kitchen, you've got your fitted wardrobes, you've got some form of joinery.
All right. Okay. So they're not including a lot of that. Yeah.
So a lot of cases, they won't have joinery. They won't have floor finishes. In some cases, it's extreme. They don't have a kitchen. So it's called grey box living.
Yeah.
You walk in. There's a pendant in the middle of the room. There's a few sockets,
and a
right?
Pipe.
And off you go.
Yeah.
Right?
That's actually very common in the rental market in Germany. And the apartments are rented without a kitchen. And you bring your own kitchen from...
My daughter's just moving to Montpellier next week to start her Erasmus year and there's no furniture. Yeah. I'm kind of going, right?
Well, actually, Ireland and the UK are the only two rental markets in the world that supply furniture.
Yeah.
In North America, it is considered, Karen's from Canada, like it's absolutely okay. Not. Like renting an apartment with furniture would be considered like, who are you?
But it's not that, like, so furniture is one thing, right, which is in and out of schemes here. But like, they have district heating, right? Yeah. Their sizes are different, but to be honest with you, while we have prescriptive sizes here, prescriptive minimum sizes, they don't.
Yeah.
Right?
So they have typically smaller apartments.
They're up and down, and you'll see it in the report. It's not actually, because there's reports that are in the Irish market published to say our sizes are X square meters percentage above. We have found that some of them were higher than ours.
Yeah.
But every scheme is different.
Yeah.
And, unless you've gone off measuring every single scheme in Copenhagen and Berlin. But so basically, one of the big differences was scope, right? We did find that mechanical and electrical pricing here was higher. However, in a lot of the schemes in mainland Europe, you've got district heating, right? Big steam pipe going down center of street, heating up your apartment block, where we have to build boilers and PV units and heat pumps and so on. So there was a difference there. And what we said was there was specification. And the one thing we found was that how the other countries and cities viewed Ireland. So they said, you have got, you know, really high health and safety standards.
Yeah.
Okay. You've got higher energy standards. Like the UK, I think it's just from the beginning of this year, they weren't allowed to put a gas boiler in.
Yeah.
Right. So our NZEB and all the other energy requirements have been here higher. They're all creeping up to get to us.
Yeah.
Right.
We're still creeping up.
Everyone is creeping up. Yeah. You know, whether we're plateauing, we'll come back to that. Yeah. But our health and safety, our BCAR, how we sign off our buildings, right, is much higher here than in the other cities. And I've seen this personally myself in other places in terms of health and safety. So there's that, you know, they don't put in en-suites, you know, things like that that are just, and when you, in the report, and whilst it's a long report, there are some tables that you can just go to the graph and just go, okay, they say it's this. And when we take the spec and scope and apples and oranges thing into account, we kind of get back to where we are.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, we said to government, you can reduce construction costs in Ireland by up to 14% if you did the same thing. But do you want to move into an apartment without a kitchen? Right? Now, there was uproar and we were getting all sorts of emails to the office to say, how dare you suggest rent is bad enough. Can't even afford the rent. Now you're not even going to give me a kitchen. Are you ridiculous?
But there's an argument to say we're not really reducing the construction costs, right? We're just passing it on to somebody
exactly.
else.
And that's what we've called it. We've called it deferred.
Yeah.
Deferred scope. The tenant, right? Carrier is going to come in here and still going to have to go off and buy furniture or go to IKEA. But we actually looked at this back in 2015 with PII, grey box living, and I thought it was an outrageous concept, right? And I don't think it'll fit here. But what this report did was to say, for once and for all, here is the comparison. Here is the detail. You're not being gouged by Irish contractors or developers, right? But, you know, construction cost is only 50% of the overall cost. The report recommends that the other half, which is soft costs, are examined also.
Yeah.
And in a recent report, when we looked at the apartment, we found that a minimum of 35% was going to the state.
Yeah. The state doesn't really react very well to that argument when it's being repeatedly made, as we have done over the years as an industry to say, and I always come back to VAT, people don't quite realize this, they're buying a house that 13.5% of what they're paying is actually going directly to the state. So when people, the Help to Buy scheme, for example, say it's costing the government 30,000 euros per unit, it absolutely is basically free for the government because they're collecting revenue on the other side that's essentially paying. They're just giving the VAT back to the customer who's buying the house.
But the other thing that did come into play, which is something that we can learn from, is standardization.
Yeah.
So when
we're terrible at that.
Yeah, we are terrible. Yeah. We are all developers are competing with each other and we have no standards.
Yeah.
As in, we're always trying to do what the local authorities did back in 2008.
Yeah.
And so when we got them to price this scheme, they said, why do you have 16 different window types in your apartments? We said, well, 16 different window types.
Yeah.
We said, well, we've got four. Because that's what you get off the end of the conveyor belt from the factories.
Yeah.
And you can place them any which way you want, but we've got four of them.
Yeah.
And they said, why do you have 10 kilometers worth of this really expensive steel channel? And we said, well, that holds up the outer line of the wall. Mm. We've got this brick facade and we've got a cavity. So this big angle has to carry the... And then, okay, I said, well, what do you do? Well, we just have an insulated clay block. And we clad the inside of it with plasterboard. We insulate it and we plaster it on the outside. And that's our wall.
Yeah.
That's a huge difference.
Can we do that here, though, under building regulations? Because I understand how the principle of that works and it works absolutely fine. And actually, most of those countries are all much colder than Ireland is in the winter. And they have no problems, right, with it. But I imagine that if you went down the road of trying to do that here, you'd face a lot of opposition from local authority, building control, fire officer, etc. Yeah.
Anytime you try and do anything new, and one of the things that we did try and get into was building regulations, which is very difficult because building regulations doesn't say your block has to be 100 mil thick. it says your U value on your facade needs to be X, which can be achieved in many different ways.
Yeah.
Building regulations, energy and fire are all creeping up. We have new fire regs about to come into play in Ireland, which are going to change the way that we design our buildings.
And they are very, very serious changes that are being made.
They're serious changes, and they will come into play. And whilst I think the biggest thing here is that the biggest change that we have to make is that changes that are being made to design and standards have to be independently viability checked. Mm. And people will say they are, but you know, if we look at the new compact housing design guidelines that are going to be coming out for consultation in 4 or 5 weeks' time, you know, what extent of viability checking has been done on them?
Yeah.
Or is it up to charity groups and like the SCSI to pull members like me in to say, can you give your free time here to do these checks, please, and issue this?
And one problem I see with that, the way things have changed in the development market in recent years, is that these changes are coming in, they invariably raise cost. And so, yeah, the SCSI and people like you will go and you'll do the work. You'll say, this is raising cost. This is terrible. But now that the market has shifted to being majority controlled by people like the LDA, people like the AHBs, who are providing solely sort of for public service housing, well, like public housing, shall we call it, right? Whether it's cost rental, cost sale, whatever, it's being 100% funded by the state. So there's no commercial pressure in the other direction against these things from that arm of the development market. Because if the cost is 300,000 euros to build a house or it's 400,000 euros to build a house, the house is needed and the check gets written by the government and then the money gets paid. And so the regulations have no pushback on them, apart from people where the economics do matter, me, you, where we say, well, actually, we can't make that work anymore. We can't build it if it's going to be that price. So, you know, maybe think about the regulations. We're getting to be a smaller and smaller part of that conversation as this sort of public housing behemoth rises around us.
Yeah.
And I wonder a lot about the regulation. You talk about viability testing. I just see it as there's just a whole load of fiefdoms among people who are writing these regulations, and they want this and the fire guys want this, and it's just, well, we get whatever we want, down to the light switches or the socket switches. I don't know if you know this, that the switches for the sockets used to be in the center, and now we've decided they have to be on the outside. And I think we're the only country in Europe that requires this. So Click or whoever it is make these socket covers have to make a separate, different one for Ireland. That's increased the cost of the socket. It's a small thing, right? But how many sockets are in an apartment? Mm. How many are in an apartment building? Mm. All of these things that we do, I mean, it would be a dream to say you can't change anything unless you viability test it.
I think you're always going to get the incremental change.
But it should be purposeful, right? It should be. Like sprinklers. We were putting sprinklers into apartments before they were required. Sprinklers are a good idea. There's a fire, sprays water on it, puts the fire out. Who can be against that? But to go from a situation where they weren't required to now we have to put telemetry to all of them, and they have to be physically inspected every year, and there has to be a commercial system because there's a car park involved. That requires, I am not joking, a swimming pool to be built underneath the basement car park to supply the thing with water. Like an enormous quantity of water, enormous pump sets, expense that is just for, and it's like, I look at it and think, why? We have all these car parks with cars in them, with no sprinkler systems. But now all of a sudden there's an imperative that there has fire suppression in car parks just because why?
And I think the other thing is that that's not consistent across the board. So we have regulations, but then we have some fire officers who say,
who can vary them at will, right?
And they'll say, I'm not going to give you your fire cert.
Yeah. And your only defense to that is go to Mbor Pleanála, take a year, by which point the building will be ready. Hopefully they will rule for you because the fire regs are meant to be the law, but maybe they won't.
Well, in a recent case, they turned around and said the fire officer is the expert, not us, going with the fire officer.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a particular county where you go, and I only had a meeting last week, and they said, this is what you're going to have to do, but it's not in the regs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know that, but you will not get a fire cert.
Yeah.
And that's just an individual.
Yeah.
That is an individual that's saying, I'm taking an overly conservative approach and you will pay.
Yeah.
Because there isn't, you know, like developers here are an easy scapegoat in one way. They are blamed all the time. I think the thing has changed a little bit over the last few years. I think people are realizing, hang on, if we don't have developers and if we don't have international funds, we are not going to get units.
Yeah.
That doesn't get down to it. Now, I do honestly believe, and this is why I'm more optimistic, I do think that the department and I do think the likes of the LDA and councils are shifting big time in terms of saying, no, no, we know what the facts are and we know where we have to go.
Yeah.
Cree Cunha, right? That's an acknowledgement that apartments for sale are not viable.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the government are going to put in up to 144 grand per unit.
Yeah.
Right? Subvention of up to 150 grand per unit for cost rental legislation is positive.
That's very positive. And they should, and I'm all for, they should be complimented for those schemes. They make a lot of sense.
Yeah. And the changes, like only 3 weeks ago, they increased the salary limits for cost rental from 59 grand up to 66 grand for Dublin.
And that's net household income, right?
That's net household income.
Yeah. So, I mean,
that's a
most
four,
people, I would say.
That's a 400 euro increase in the allowable rent.
Yeah.
And that makes, because we're involved in a lot of cost rental schemes, and that makes a world of difference.
Yeah.
But take it that in a cost rental scheme, things that don't work are a high percentage of three beds.
Yeah.
Take it that you have a recent planning permission near where you live, that in condition four of the planning that was granted said, love your scheme, just change, you know, the three, I want to up the level of three beds to over 25%.
Mm.
That kills cost rental.
Yeah.
Like, moves like that just set back a scheme and think about judicial review, think about planning, think about all that that has to go through, right?
Yeah.
So that scheme is set back by 2 years and we're running on inflation of 5 or 6% per annum. Like, things like that are criminal. And at the beginning of this year, when we issued our info cards, we said we needed a 3-year emergency. We needed a 3-year emergency to bridge this gap.
Yeah.
And we needed to do things that you wouldn't ordinarily do. And there were things around a rebate on VAT. There were things around nilling planning contributions for 3 years. Grateful it came in for 12 months. Fantastic, yeah. Right? And other things that, but we have to do those things now. But some of those things are happening. They're happening on the public side.
Yeah.
That subvention is happening on the public side. And it's an interesting point you raised then about, well, who's thinking about the private developer now?
Well, this is the thing. The private developer, and I say this a lot and people think I'm just like whinging, which I am whinging. We, as an industry, are going extinct. A lot of people got wiped out in the crash. You can have your own opinion as to whether NAMA and how all that was done was right or wrong. I personally think it was a frigging disaster. But that wiped a lot of people out. People got old. People retired. People died. Whenever I go to any of the lobby meetings or breakfasts or any of that stuff, I'm invariably one of the youngest people in the room. I'm not that young anymore. I was when I first started going. I was a little kid and I'm sure people were looking at me funny. But there is nobody getting into the space of development now.
Yeah. And you know, part of our work with the Housing Commission was I went and spoke to the German Housing Commission.
Oh, I'd be interested to hear what that was.
Yeah.
Like.
And a 2-hour conversation with a very friendly economist, and he said they spent 2 years working in a particular commission, which is on the reduction of construction costs. The commission's for different things.
Okay.
He said they spent 2 years working with a, you know, very expert group to come up with 78 recommendations. 16 were implemented and construction costs went up. Right?
I thought there was going to be a happy point of that story, Paul.
Don't do happy. Private parties. But the interesting thing was then that 2 hours, you could have interchanged the word Germany with Ireland all through,
yeah.
Right? And where they're at, right, is zero profit companies, AHBs, but zero profit, coming in. And what they do is they take land. So the state get land, and then they go out to developers, to you, and they say, okay, give me your best bid for this site, including your proposal. So it's a bit like the O'Devney Gardens model.
Okay.
And so you'll say, okay, I'm going to give you a third cost rental, a quarter, you know, affordable purchase, a bit for sale, and I'm going to put the rest on the private market. The level of subvention that they have is huge. And it was a real eye opener for me, because it meant, hang on, this is how, and they are struggling. They can't meet their numbers. The UK can't meet the numbers. The US can't meet their numbers.
They're throwing money at it. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And the thing about it is, when you look at it, because all our conversation today has been around viability. And when you then bring the affordability piece into play, that is when the real conversation starts. Because you might say an apartment, like when we were building apartments in Sandyford back in the 2000s, two bed apartments were being sold for 550, 600, 630 grand back then, right? Today's price is 430, 480, 510.
Which adjusted is half,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So like, so why did it work for, like the metrics have completely changed. So construction costs, you know, are not going to go down. Site values will reduce depending on supply and demand.
But they're already low anyway. So
they've reduced actually 39% on average since we did our SCSI report.
Yeah, which makes a lot of sense. But we're seeing the point now where site values are so low, particularly for apartment sites, that it's almost immaterial. Like land used to be a third of our cost, right?
Yeah,
like 20 years ago.
No, third,
right? That's what we used to have. And now it's sort of 7-8%.
Exactly, yeah.
So even if land prices were to fall 50% from where they are now, that shaves 3%.
And you know what the big issue here is that everybody that talks about their own particular part of that 50%, you have 50%, which is construction.
Yeah.
You have the other 50% of soft costs, which includes site.
Yeah.
But when you look at that pie chart, right, each bit is only 5 to 10%.
Yeah.
So when you talk to the councils or the government about reducing planning contributions, how does that move the needle?
Yeah.
If we reduce planning contributions by 50%, it changes the needle by 2%.
Yeah.
Just the example you've given on the site. VAT. Not sure if I take it off VAT that the developers are just going to bid more on the sites, which is a hazard.
It is, yeah.
So that, but a VAT rebate would look to kind of change that. If you sell below a particular level, then you get your VAT. If you don't, you don't.
Hmm.
There's ways around that, I believe. So that's the problem. The bit, so therefore people only want to go after the chunky bit, which is the construction costs, which for all the reasons we've talked about are going to incrementally climb. They're going to wax and wane with the market and tender price levels, and then we'll probably see some adjustment at the beginning of next year. But, you know, for the most part, we are just incrementally going up.
And each of those construction costs, in a way, is also a little bit of the pie chart. Like we can say 50% of it is construction, but actually 1% of it is bricks and 2% of it is steel or whatever. So you need all of those things to fall. And the only common component of them is energy and logistics. But everything else is different, right? There's clay goes into bricks and there's ore goes into steel and timber comes from. So we like to just lump it into one basket and say construction costs, but there's vast number of commodities involved.
Oh yeah,
particularly nowadays.
Yeah, and part of the hyperinflation that we experienced, for the first time, we were analysing buildings not on composite rates as how much it is to put a cube of concrete in place. It was, you know, where does the rebar come from, and why are we now tracking scrap steel prices in Turkey? For cars, because that's the raw material that's used to make rebar, and we get the rebar from there, and the rebar comes and it makes our concrete. So it's mind-boggling, you know, when you get into it, right? And you can see that an explosion in some factory in America that makes some little insulation chemical threw all our prices.
Yeah,
you know, we were during COVID, we actually were getting so many questions every day from clients, but when everything was changing, that we just started issuing this weekly COVID update, which then became a kind of death rate upgrade. Our graphs had changed from cost per square meter and concrete and steel to deaths, and it was kind of crazy. But it showed the kind of global supply chain impact on construction costs. And that has settled down somewhat.
Though in recent weeks has been kicking off a little bit again.
There's opportunism. But the one thing that we haven't touched on, and we'll do that over the next half hour, is availability and resources.
Yeah.
Now, the whole world is short of resources, right? But we are short of contractors, we're short of suppliers. And what happens when, you know, hopefully in the short term, Ukraine situation ceases and we get into a rebuild situation, right?
Yeah.
We've already lost a lot of Eastern European workers back to Europe. Post-COVID. There are all these other things coming down the track. And we've got developers who went through the crash before, like the developers you talked about, and they're more conservative now, mm-hmm. right? And they're not going to take that chance.
Absolutely not going to take that. They're not going to take, and they're not going to be let, because the funding won't be there for them to take those chances either. You touched on costs and shortages of resources. And one of the things I had down here was to talk to you about MMC, modern methods of construction, which most people take to mean modular building. I'm going to give you our take on modular, right? So we've looked at this every which way. We, in the past, up to now, have made the bathrooms in all of our apartment buildings have been modular, right? They've been bathroom pods. They were made in near Limerick and then in Nina, steel frame, perfectly nice bathroom, all the same. I don't know how many of we bought, thousands of them, and they worked fine. We then went and started doing the plant rooms in the apartments modularly. So very similar. Again, they're not tiled, but they have sort of a plastic cladding inside. We do all the mechanical heat recovery and a heat pump. We do it all the same in all the apartments. It's a hot water tank with integrated heat pump, all in a little box, modular, got delivered, worked fine. We then thought, okay, well, let's take it a step further and see, can we do the kitchens? No, can't do it. Too many different types of kitchen. The kitchens are already technically manufactured offsite, but we were kind of hoping we could get the whole thing, you know, in one piece and drop it in, save time. No, too difficult. So then I started just getting curious and looking into modular construction around the world. And the only place I found that seems to be doing it fairly reliably is in Asia. So in Japan, in Malaysia, in places like this, particularly in Japan, they have a huge issue with labor there. They can't get any. So they have come up with modular buildings and they work well. They're all the same. Every floor is exactly the same the whole way up. In the UK, they're doing it. John Fleming, I think, is probably, if not the biggest, one of the biggest people there doing modular construction. But in Ireland, it just doesn't seem to fly. Like, it's hard to even make precast work from what we've seen. It's like, you can do it, but it actually doesn't cost any less. It, in some cases, costs more, and say, okay, well, your time on site is less, so there's a safety benefit to that. But other than that, not really much of a saving. Mm. Tell me I'm wrong. Tell me you have the solution.
You're wrong. I have the solution.
Okay.
No, you have to edit it a bit out. I think there's been a lot of movement, and MMC is a broad church, and it's become a bit of a buzzword over the last couple of years.
It has, and I should say that. It has become a thing that people throw out to be like, that's politically, you hear it a lot. Well, we'll reduce construction costs, we'll just use MMC because it'll be cheaper. And you say, well, will it be? Don't worry about that. Look at these magic beans and vote for me. But yeah, so it's a buzzword, but it has been an area of focus for a lot of people who are attracted to the idea of making things in a factory, the same way cars are made in a factory. If we're going to build a Mercedes, we might as well build it in a factory. What we do right now is build it in a factory outside. Kevin, who works here with us on the cost control side, he was says, what we do is we build houses in a factory with no roof, and every single house is different. And we have like 35 people come along going, do it this way, do it that way. I don't like it.
Mm.
And that's the way we operate our business, which is, you would say on the face of it, crazy.
Mm.
Yeah. But we haven't seen a better option.
Yeah. And like the there's a fantastic report that was produced by the World Economic Forum for 4 or 5 years old, looking at the construction industry. It's the best report I've seen.
Okay.
Because it addresses all of the issues that people, because people talk about it, it's such a fragmented industry, right? look at the average number of workers in a construction company in Ireland. It's like single digits.
Yeah.
It's crazy, right? Yeah. Now pit every one of them against each other and get them to bid for a prototype every time.
Yeah, it's a prototype. Yeah.
You're not building a Mercedes.
No.
You're building, you know, a mix between a Mercedes, a Porsche, and a Fiesta, yeah. Right? Maybe. And maybe that'll change during the course, right? So we're trying to tie up a prototype with a factory process, right? And that gives rise to challenge. So in the UK, you know, the report was modernize or die, right? Probably 4 or 5 years ago. And it was like all about MMC and mainly modular. And that moniker came out last year to say modernize and die. Because of the amount of insolvency in modular.
And that has been crazy to see the amount of insolvencies.
But it's not like if I have a car, if I have a factory producing Toyotas and I'm spitting them out the door, right? And then suddenly the whole world says, I don't want Toyotas. What do? You have to shut your factory down. Mm. You can't keep it going and pile up Toyotas in the car park, right? And that's effectively what we're trying to do. So, And in order to do it, we looked at this previously, and we looked at a scheme here of 900 student beds, one scheme, modular. And we went to Sweden with the developer. We saw the modules being constructed on site, and it literally was two bedrooms, corridor in the middle, 40-foot containers.
Lego,
right? And then put on the facade. We then left with that developer from Sweden, and we traveled to China. We spent a week on a very hot factory floor trying to see how we would put Irish B car on these boxes that were being built in China. And, you know, you talk about fire. So then for every box that was different, we'd send to France, burn it, spend $100,000. And the regulatory risk, and I said it to this particular client, I said, I don't want to be sitting here with 400 units sitting out there in a ship in Dublin port. With someone saying,
No, put them in
and then I'll see whether I'll approve them or not. So you need buy-in from all sorts to be able to do that. So that is modular MMC is very tricky. It was done here. Apartment buildings were built here in the boom by Mr. Fleming.
Yeah.
That are still standing today. But the MMC more so is all about just different technologies. It's more about, they call it about 2D and 3D. So it's about getting a flat panel. So I might get my wall built in heavy gauge, light gauge steel, right? So I just throw up the wall. It's vertical. It might come with its windows.
Yeah.
We're currently doing the sidings office building, which is really interesting to look at because we are now just lifting. So we've put built the building in concrete and now we're putting up the brick, the precast, and the glazing all in panels. They're just going up. So that's MMC.
Yeah.
Designed 3 years ago. So the future for MMC, I think it shouldn't be, we shouldn't be negative about it. It's not a panacea, but it will be more 2D than 3D.
Yeah.
Hotel chains have done modular. Part of the Shelbourne Hotel is modular.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense for hotels, right? Because they want it to be exactly the same.
I can't remember which hotel group it was, but their findings on it was slightly more expensive. It was in the single digits, more expensive construction-wise, but it saved on time. If you're in a time-sensitive zone and you've just bought a site in Manhattan and you have to get that revenue flown and your IRR is under pressure, it makes sense.
Yeah.
If you're doing an apartment scheme that may have 3 to 6 months flex in it, right? And we've looked at it here for other student schemes. But I think, and when you look at any of the time-lapse videos and you see a house being built, you see all these workers going on the site, right? And they're all digging and putting down cables and trenches and foundations, right? And this takes forever on this 60-second video. And then that's the house gone up.
Yeah.
Because it's just delivered to site. And then the other 24 seconds, right, is them putting the roof on, gluing the three bits together, right? Yeah. And so it's part of a solution, but it's not an overall solution.
Because a lot of the work that you see, the house just comes to site, but somebody made that house as well, and that was human beings. There weren't robots that did that.
Exactly, yeah.
I've kept you here more than an hour so far, so apologies for that.
I've probably kept you here more than an hour.
No, I mean, I find it very interesting. I actually think it's going to be great. I think people are going to like it. Carrie is our litmus test. You still awake?
Glazed over yet?
You're still awake.
No, I saw the head hit the table.
Extra coffee this morning.
Edit that out later on.
Other things that you're working on. I know that you have this report coming out, and maybe you can't talk about it, the sprawl, the cost of sprawl. You probably can't give me the details as to what you found, but you are looking into how all that works. And I find that very interesting because last episode we talked to Colin McCarthy, and he was making the point about sprawl and how kind of the horse is bolted a bit. Like, we've already done the sprawl, so now let's not make the mistake of layering, you know, bullshit transport solutions like rail on top of it just to make ourselves feel better. But you're doing a report that's looking at more nuanced costs around sprawl, whether it's happened or whether we're going to do it. Mm. But there are real costs to it.
There absolutely are. One of the things we found, so our report is a high-level report, because to try and understand the cost of sprawl is a 1 to 2 year exercise. First off, you say, well, look, you know, first pass, is there an issue, right? Yeah. There was a 2006 European Economic Report about Ireland to say that it was probably the worst cases of sprawl in Europe.
Gosh.
One of the things that I didn't know up until a few months ago was that they fly an airplane over the entire of Europe at low altitude every 2 years and photograph the landmass.
Really?
If you look up Corine, Corine, maps, right? You can actually go in to any part of Ireland and see the change in, they do it in different time periods, right?
Okay.
But you can go in and see the difference between 2006 and 2012. Some of them are wider than others.
Really? And that's just publicly available?
Publicly, it's online. And you go in and you can see where land, they check forestation, deforestation, commercial, residential, right? So one of the things that we're doing is we've had a lot of interaction with the public utility companies, but is to come up with a theoretical scenario and say, if we built at a denser level and we didn't have to connect to this town over here, how much would we save? And figures are yet to be finalized. But there is a cost, right? Now, there's some fascinating reports actually in Canada. One of the places they looked at, and they've actually worked out the capital cost of urban sprawl per head and the operational cost per head.
Wow.
And the cost of commuting to your health, the thesis has been done in Ireland, the cost of accidents, the environmental cost. Like, we know without doing the 1 to 2 year research that it costs money.
Yeah.
Ireland has an infrastructure deficit all over the place.
Yeah.
Electricity, sewage, water. And we're a country that started off in a very large bog with trails. And over the last few thousand years, we've tarmacked the trails and we've all these roads. And therefore, we're a dispersed country. And then we've tried to connect all these people with electricity and water. So we have this extra cost. So I think cost of sprawl. So horse is bolted, but we can bring the horse back into the stable.
Well, we can stop bringing the horse out into the field with the open gate. That would be a start.
Yeah.
I don't think we're making much progress on that.
Yeah, again, I'm going to be positive here for a second. If you look at the changes that are out, so the government came out for consultation about this new compact living, right? Which, you know, had been put out there by the RAI, it's been put out there by some of the private developers, and got some negative feedback in some quarters, right?
What was the negative the negative feedback was when Stephen Garvey said that we should make the back gardens a little bit smaller, and people went absolutely nutso about that,
which
totally nuanced reaction to what
and people in my mind got the wrong... That was taken up wrong, as these things often do.
I mean, if you listen to just 10 seconds of what he said, you would realize that was totally out of context. Like, that's not, he wasn't saying people shouldn't have gardens. He was saying maybe if we just shrink it a little bit
Yeah, and it was. It was just we're living with standards that are very old, yeah. right? And we have a moral obligation and an environmental obligation to make better use of our land.
Yeah.
We are putting in 3- and 4-bed semi-detached houses that are not occupied by 4 or 5 people, respectively. Our average household size is 2.7. We have a huge issue around our housing need demand analysis and the mismatch with the census. Like, that's a whole other conversation that I think you discussed a little bit with John Denny. But when the regulations changed, said we don't want to build 30 units per hectare anymore, or dwellings per hectare, they've changed it to now, we want to build 50. So then that meant the developers had to try and build apartment blocks out in Lucan yeah. or Maynooth or Kilcock.
Where they're not needed.
Where their people don't want, they don't yeah. commute out that long, far. They want a 3-bed semi-D with the garden, mm. right? So there was viability issues. And next thing you found that the houses were actually subventing the apartments.
Yeah.
And now there's a new typologies, which are really welcome to be put out there about, you know, a mix, duplexes, houses, and so on. And that's what we need. And it goes back to the point about having a graduated ladder of housing typologies, which doesn't stop at your house. It's your trade down. It's your senior living. It's your supported housing. It's your nursing home. It's your final home. But I think some of that stuff is going to be fascinating. But again, this is the point where we could make an absolute mistake.
Yeah.
This is like 2008. And on our website, you'll see apartments. Are we repeating the mistakes of the past, where we catalogue from 2007 up to last year?
Yeah.
Right. And this is right at the point where you go, oh no, don't put a new typology in place that's not tested. Right. Is it going to produce more people? Is it actually going to be more dense, or is it just going to be more dense because of the amount of units?
Mm.
And there's a nuance in there, and we need to be very careful with that nuance.
Mm. Mm.
And that's why you need quantity surveyor to look at your schemes.
Well, that feels like a natural place to release you from the prison of this room. But before you go, I ask everybody about the magic wand. If you could change one thing. Now, some people have tried to hijack this by saying, well, I changed this, and because of that, I changed this. One thing, yeah, you can literally just go in to tomorrow to the Dáil or to wherever, building control, and you can say, we're not doing this anymore.
I'd add 200 people to on board Planola.
200 people to board, so planners and inspectors and people like that. Yeah, clear out the planning backlog.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like a bad idea.
It's a simple idea.
Yeah. I think they are trying to do that. I mean, I was on a panel a while ago with somebody from the Department of Housing, and she had said that there was a huge recruitment drive for Port Planola, but they're really struggling to get people.
Yeah. We have other parts of the world that aren't experiencing what we're experiencing. Our thing that we said in part of our 3-year emergency that we said in January was go to the UK, get planning consultants.
Yeah.
And second them in, pay them. Think about the money we're losing. We actually worked out the cost of judicial reviews. The
money we're losing is,
right?
Yeah.
So pay the planners 20 grand more,
yeah.
right? What is 20 grand in our crisis? Zip.
Yeah.
3-year emergency. If the government think about it as an emergency, we will do things like we did in COVID. Lots of cycle tracks that we never would have had if we didn't have COVID
yeah.
or people working at home. Do things like that. Temporary, I know there's always an issue with temporary measures. Put those in place. The 3-year emergency, deal with it, knock it on the head, because the deficit, when you and I are talking in 3 or 4 years' time, we will talk about the deficit of this time period.
Yeah.
And the mistakes made now.
Yeah. And the reaction to that. So, Paul, thanks very much for coming down, for giving us your time. I know that it wasn't just today. We had our warm-up call, and you did a lot of research too. And it's been very helpful for me, because I feel like I've learned a lot, particularly from the reports that you guys write. And, you know, you do all that, like you say, on a voluntary basis. You're not paid for it. So it is a real benefit to the industry, and it's a benefit to anyone else who wants to learn about costs and learn about how the development industry works. So I want to thank you not only for today, but for that work that you and your colleagues are doing. And let's see, come back in 3 years and see how the 3-year emergency has gone.
Very good.
The Build is hosted by me, Rick Larkin. Carrie Fernandez produced this episode. Original music was written by Cass. If you have a suggestion for the show or know someone we should interview, please let me know by email, rick@thebuildpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.